You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet, and story is everything.
It's everything, and tonight is episode 23.
Okay, we're Jim and Bobby Bell, your hosts.
And we're so delighted that you're joining us again this week, whether you're watching live tonight, listening to live audio, or you catch us down the road. We really appreciate that you tune in. And what was that music? What was that toe-tapping music?
That's from Alex Dormont, Hot Texas Swing Band.
And that's Hot Texas, and we appreciate we get to open and show, open and close the show every week with that music. And who are our guests tonight?
We have two guests tonight. This is the first Thursday of the month. We have Henry Park with True West Magazine. Hi, Henry. Hi. And our special guest tonight is Mark Jackson, author and songwriter and performer.
And
a good group.
A full house. And we're delighted to see both of you gentlemen with us tonight.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Henry, what's the latest news on Western films and TV shows, especially since you are the film editor? Hold up the magazine.
Well, I did.
I know, but now
we'll can't show it too often.
The film editor for one of our favorite publications, True West Magazine. What's going on, Henry?
Well, I'm delighted to say that there's been a lot of Western and what sort of Western adjacent news of late. First up this month, a brand new channel will launch on Dish, the Cowgirl Channel. It'll be a 24 hours a day devoted to women's Western sports. I would call it rodeo. It's the sister channel to, you guessed it, the Cowboy Channel, which is the official pro rodeo channel. Now, if you have Netflix, there's a new Eastern to check out. Pale Blue Eye stars Christian Bale as a 19th century PI hired to investigate a murder at West Point.
That sounds good.
And for us writer types, the really fun idea is that Harry Melling plays a cadet named Edgar Allan Poe, who helps with the investigation. Now, it's not a true story, but it is true that Poe was a cadet at West Point at that time. It's co-written and directed by Scott Cooper, who made the excellent Hostiles, and directed Jeff Bridges to his Oscar in Crazy Heart.
And the
cast includes Toby Jones, Gillian Anderson, and Robert Duvall, which is, for me, reason enough to watch, even if, frankly, it relies too much on contrivances and coincidences. And coming to Amazon Prime on February 17th is an 8-part Mexican-Western miniseries, La Cabeza de Joaquin Murrieta, or The Head of Joaquin Murrieta, based on the life of the Mexican bandit or freedom fighter, depending on your point of view.
Yeah.
Now, the trailer I saw was in Spanish, with subtitles, also in Spanish. But I assume it'll be dubbed or subtitled in English when they run it. But it certainly appeared to be very elegantly produced. I just had no idea what was going on. But that's often the case in trailers. Another new Western coming to VOD on February 21st is Bordello. And all the men perk up. Take that any way you want. Level 33 Entertainment. It's the story of five soiled doves working in a New Mexico brothel in 1889, banding together to protect a 7-year-old girl from sharing their fate.
New Mexico.
It's and it is an elegant looking thing. I mean, I got to say the brothel looks a lot more like a finishing school to me. I mean, it's just much classier than I would expect, but very interesting looking. Coming to Tucson, March 16th through the 19th is the first annual, hopefully, Television West Fest. The folks who in the past have run High Chaparral reunions, and I think Bonanza ones as well, are gathering stars of a number of Western series for this one. Attending will be Mitch Vogel, the last Cartwright from Bonanza, Robert Carradine from many things, including the Cowboys, Michael Dante from Custer, Michael McGreevy from Riverboat, Roberta Shaw from The Virginian, Darby Hinton, who's Israel on The Daniel Boone Show, Rudy Ramos from High Chaparral, Bo Svensson from Here Come the Brides, Charlotte Stewart from Little House on the Prairie, and more.
Wow.
I just had the chance to interview Mitch Vogel and Michael McGreevy, and you can see those interviews coming soon to the INSP blog. Yeah. And they both have great stories to tell. You know, if I was, I don't think I'm going to get the Tucson, but if you do, definitely talk to them. They're great people. And I understand the ticket prices are going up February 13th. So if you plan to attend, make your reservation soon. Now, the other Western-related news is that Alec Baldwin and arborer Hannah Gutierrez-Reed have been formally charged with involuntary manslaughter in the accidental shooting death of cinematographer Halina Hutchins on the set of Rust. Now, as far as the armorer goes, an innocent person got killed on her watch. So unless there are extenuating circumstances, to me, her situation is pretty cut and dry. I find this a tough call for Baldwin. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not an armorer. I'm just, you know, one guy with too many opinions. John Schneider has said that he always checks his firearms personally on the set to make sure they're safe, and that, you know, everyone that's going to point a gun at somebody should do that. Mm-hmm. Mickey Rourke points out that the Screen Actors Guild has never required or even suggested that actors should be checking their weapons themselves. Mm-hmm. I was wondering what you folks think.
I'm like you, Henry. I don't know. It feels just like all new news to me. And I'm, you know, we're not actors. I've only picked up a gun once years ago on a firing range. Until you have one in your hand, you have a whole different perspective on things when you actually have one in your hand and you fire it, you know?
Yes.
But certainly it feels like all kinds of news has been coming out, at least here. It's nightly news here in New Mexico and Albuquerque.
I'm sure you're hearing much more than we are.
We're hearing much, you know, more details now than we have heard up till now. So,
you know, it's kind of a situation. Baldwin suspected his people have done this. People have jobs to take care of this kind of situation. We have two people involved. We had an assistant director who apparently pleaded something, and he's out of the situation, mm-hmm. who also was involved in this. And then we have the lady, her number one job. We also know that we have people that we know that we left the scene for a while, and the weapon and the gun, you know, weapon was, nobody paying attention to it. I don't know what the shells. I'd have to ask a lot of questions myself. What else might be going on?
Is there a conspiracy there? Could this be murder?
Well, I don't know. You've got
that's the next story to write, right? After it's all over, somebody will write about it.
Exactly.
You'll be telling about it in about 3 years. Well, on Netflix.
Well, I was hoping 6 months, but okay.
Yeah.
I personally think that, you know, gun education is a real good idea, and the idea of everybody double checking their weapons in addition to an armorer doing it might be a really good policy moving forward.
Right.
But I've been on a lot of sets with a lot of guns. I mean, I have not handled them because I've been there as press, but I've seen an awful lot of them handled. And the armorer has always been the person who is handing it to them right before the take and taking it back the moment they're done. And they check everything out. And I think it would be unfair to punish Alec Baldwin for a policy that doesn't exist yet, even if it should exist. Yeah. And I know a lot of people say, you know, Baldwin was the producer on the film, so he has more responsibility. But we know how meaningless producing credits can be, especially on a low budget film. They give them away like candy.
Oh.
Because it's what you give in lieu of money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we'll all see what happens.
Well, we'll see. Right. We'll see. Well, Henry, where can people read more about, where can they go find all this great information that you shared?
Well, you know, you can read about all of this. You can, I should ask you to check out the new True West. I believe that's when you held up my article on the shooting of the film Farhaven at the Mezcal movie set.
Right.
And you can read all about these things and so much more at www.henryswesternroundup.blogspot.com.
Thank you, Henry.
And
thank you for staying with us. We're going to now go ahead and welcome Mr. Mark C. Jackson, who has been with us from the beginning here. Jim has a little something to share, Mark, and then we're going to start talking about your music and books.
Okay. I'm ready.
We have a little bio here. Mark Jackson, award-winning author, singer, songwriter, and builder of things. Mark Jackson is a veteran wordsmith with a passion for Western historical fiction. He is known for his ability to give readers a realistic depiction of 1800s frontier life. And all three of his titles in his series, The Tales of Zebediah Creed, have received endorsements from the most acclaimed Western writers in the country. Please welcome Mark Jackson. All right.
Welcome, Mark.
Thanks for thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we've learned, of course, that you're incredibly multi-talented. And one of the things that when we were chatting the other night that we discovered, of course, is music in common and musician friends in common. And before we start talking about the books, we would like to talk a little bit about your music background.
Sure.
I have in my hand, I'm going to hold it up to the camera. It'll have a little glare, but this is one of your albums. This was Love May Take the Long Road Home.
Yep.
You want to share a little bit about your music and then talk a little bit about the title track, because then we're going to play it.
Sure. Well, I came to San Diego with the Navy, and I was in the Navy all my 20s, and once I got settled in, I got out in 89, and then I started looking around to do some music. I had done some coffee houses and open mics and things like that, but I really wanted to get involved in the community. And so I ended up hooking up with a guy named Peter Boland, and we did a duo through most of the 90s, actually, 91, 92 to about 97. And, you know, played a lot of coffee houses. And, you know, that's where you learn how to perform, is, you know, those places. An acoustic guy like me. We did pretty good. Our biggest gig was opening for Arlo Guthrie in 1996. And, that was really cool. We wrote a bunch of songs together and made a record together. And it was just a great time to be, playing kind of folky Americana music here in San Diego. And that's still a great, great community today. It still continues. And then Peter and I went our separate ways, and then I started I really wasn't going to do music anymore until our great friend Ken Wilcox comes along.
All right.
We know 1999, blame it on him. I hope he's listening. I called him last night.
All right.
Yeah. And I have to get permission from you guys to give him your phone number. He wants to give you a call. So.
Yes, hey, absolutely.
Good. Okay, good, good. So he and Darlene are in living in Tucson now. So So anyway, Kenny, we met through a mutual friend, and he came over at the house, and we started playing guitars together. And I sang him a few of my songs, and he said, he gets out on the sidewalk outside, and he goes, you know, he's got that deep voice, and he says, we're going to do some music together there. Boy, he always called me boy.
He always called you.
And I said, well, okay, you know. And I sent him, I think four songs I recorded. And I said, learn these and then come to this. I did have a gig, a solo gig. And, he showed up, and then we started putting music together. you know, we played together in my band and just duo. And at one point we were a full seven-piece band, five, six, seven-piece band till about 2008, recorded three records together. So I'm real proud of this. And this is the middle one of the records I made in 2000, the decade. Mm-hmm. So, he's on this, and I chose this song because his guitar playing is really good. And then he called me out of the blue one day. Again, we kind of parted our ways, and I went on and did some other things, and he called me out of the blue and says, "Hey boy, you want to be in a Western band?" And I go, "Well, I don't know. Tell me a little bit about it." And he goes, "Well, it's with Bruce Huntington on bass, and it'd be you and me and Bruce." And
we knew Bruce.
We know Bruce. You
guys know Bruce. Bruce is well known in the Western music community.
We love Bruce. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So we did this trio and for, a little while. And then we decided to add a multi-instrumentalist, just a great guy. I hope Tom Wolverton hears this because I'm dropping his name big time. Just banjo, mandolin, guitar, vocals. He wrote one song, I think, in his whole life, and it's my favorite song we ever did. It's called Dry Land. It's just a great song. And so we started doing Sidewinder, and we called ourselves Sidewinder. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot more music outside of the state, San Diego area, than I ever did with my band. We went up to Santa Clarita. We played up there near where you guys used to be at the Santa Clarita Festival. We didn't make the inside the festival. We played outside, out on the railroad, railroad platform. Mm-hmm. And that was fun.
Yeah.
But we got over to Sierra Vista to the Folk Center over there, and we played in Tucson. And we had a good run. Kenny said last night, "We could still be doing it today." And I go, "Yeah, okay, well."
Well, tell us a little bit about Love May Take the Long Way Home. Just set up that song for us. We're only going to play a little over a minute of it. Yes, but tell us about it.
Well, it's at the time I was writing a lot of songs about relationships and about the power of love. And that's that whole record that you're holding. By the way, I have no idea how you got that. I had to have sent that to you guys.
I think you had to have.
Years ago, years ago.
Yeah.
So, but this song is the title track to the record, and I wrote this profound statement about it. It says, "It's about holding on, because love will get us through our darkest times."
Here we go. Let's take a listen. Love May Take the Long Way Home.
When you were young, searching for a heart of gold, swore by simple innocence it never would grow old. Now you swear at a crazy world where the streets are filled with danger, no more next door neighbors, all your friends are strangers. So you find you walk a line between innocence and sorrow. You're doing your best today not to give up on tomorrow. Yes, and sometimes your love may take a long road home. So keep the wind behind you, don't dare go alone. And every time you turn around, something more is shown. Love may take a long road home.
Love May Take the Long Road Home, a title track from this album, Mark C. Jackson, the band.
Great song.
Yeah, and you
that
know,
that sounded pretty good.
It just sounded sure great.
And I'm glad I got these headphones on.
Well, I have to tell you something. When I was listening to it last night and preparing it for tonight's show, I got thinking about Love, Long Road Home, and actually Zebadiah Creed very much came up in my mind, and we're going to talk about in just a moment. We're going to switch gears and we're going to talk about your book series. But I watched, we watched an interesting interview that you did last fall with another author, and she asked a question about home. And so I began thinking about that song and thinking about Zebediah Creed and that he takes a long road home.
It does indeed.
And he has a lot of things that happen along the way.
Yeah. Very short period in his life, but a lot goes on.
It does. So we are going to take a very quick break, and we're going to talk about the Out West Shop affiliate bookshop page, and then we're going to talk about the Zebediah Creed series. Don't touch that dial.
Very good.
Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. Special guest tonight, Henry Park and Mark Jackson. And we're about ready to talk about one of Mark's books.
Yes.
Are we not?
Yes, yes. We're talking tonight about the third book in the trilogy. I'm trying to get better at holding things up to the camera. This is Blue Rivers of Heaven, and it's book three. And take it away, Jim.
Oh, my goodness. You know, we have a backdrop here, Mark, of mountain man and kind of the Texas fight for independence, and kind of leading up to subjects like slavery. How did this all come about? How did you start thinking about writing the book and then writing a trilogy?
Well, I wasn't a writer. I didn't even consider writing anything until I was in my 50s. I could tell you my age, but you could probably figure it out anyway. I was a songwriter, wrote many songs and did these records and performed all over. And then I started writing some poetry, but I wrote this one song called Old Lady on the Run. And this will circle back to what I'm doing today, actually. And I wanted to, it was about my grandmother and her two sisters, and they went on the run, and when they were young, and robbing banks and all that. Now, this is a fictional story, I have to admit. You know, this is a made up thing. But I thought it was so profound, that not that my writing is profound, but the idea was profound, that I could write a play. So I took a class in dialogue. Well, then that led to a class in flash fiction or short fiction, 1,000 words or less. So I wrote this short story called The Hanging. Mm-hmm. And it came from a dream that I had back in my 20s about I was a scout crossing the prairie. I had to get these people to safety or else they would die. We'd all die. And one of the men hung his wife. And that was, you know, very clear in my mind. Well, I thought, well, I'll just write that story. And I did. And this is in 2011. And it was taken, you know, it was accepted real well in the class. And I thought, well, I'll just keep writing. And you guys had asked me on Tuesday, the next story, I was just going to write these stories about Zeb, you know. And the next story was set in, that was the hangings, 1846, 47, along the mm-hmm. Cimarron Trail. Mm-hmm. If you know any history, that's heading down to Santa Fe. Mm-hmm. I just picked out, well, I'll tell him to tell a story about him in 1836 in New Orleans. Now, I don't, you know, ask other writers how they get, you know, figure this out. I don't know. It just came mm-hmm. to me. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a revenge story. And in the meantime, I had met Chet Cunningham through a friend of mine who I worked with. And Chet's a famous writer. He wrote all kinds of stuff. He wrote all kinds of pulp fiction. He made his living out here in La Mesa, California, writing his whole life. And he wrote 375 books by the time he was done. He really kick-started, what's Mike Bray's Wolfpack Publishing. I mean, Chet was the guy that started those guys with his backlog and all that.
Okay.
So I got involved with Chet's writers group, San Diego Professionals Writers Group, and I brought these little stories, and he loved the hanging, hated the New Orleans thing, but he said, take the New Orleans thing and, you know, really write a book about it. Mm-hmm. And so that's how an eye for an eye came about. Well, that was originally going to be a 5,000 word piece. In the meantime, he leaves New Orleans. And at the time, October 1835, there's a group called the New Orleans Grays that go to Texas to fight in the revolution. They were like mercenaries or militia people. And where would Zeb go after, you know, he leaves New Orleans? He would go there. He would either go up and go back to Anna, who we know from the first book and the third book, his true love, but he doesn't. He goes to Texas. And I wrote a bunch of chapters on Texas. And then I met Tiffany Schofield at my first Western Writers of America conference in 2014. She loves Zebediah Creed. She's a publisher with senior editor with Five Star Publishing. And then she asked, we were sitting in a bar when I'd already pitched her the book, and we're sitting in the bar. This is in Sacramento. And she goes, hit me. And I bought her a drink, right? So she hits me. You think you can get that first story in New Orleans? You think you can write a book about it, you know, and make it into a book? I was scared to death to tell her no. So I told her yes. And a year later, I was in, we were in Texas at the next Western Writers, and the finished manuscript 2015 was in her inbox. So I credit Chet Cunningham as my mentor and the San Diego Writers Group and all those great guys, great, great group of writers. And just, I wouldn't be here talking to you if it wasn't for those guys today. So
Zebediah Creed is the main character through all of these books. He's quite an individual.
He can be, yeah.
Yeah. And he's also a man of small words. This is written through the first person.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting to me that at least book three, which is the book that we read, the latest book in the series, that he's writing it as a recollection. He's writing like 40 years in the future, looking back.
Yeah, 1880s.
And he's with Sam at the urging of Sam Clemens, which I thought was very interesting.
Yeah, well, that's a kind of a writerly thing.
Yeah.
It just naturally came through his voice and his narration. So it's obviously going to be first person narrative, very narrow perspective, only through his eyes and ears and ideas.
I liked that it was written in first person, and he is fierce and fearless and loyal, and pretty much of one mind. I mean, he's a very determined, wouldn't you say?
Oh yeah.
And I would not want him as an, I would want him on my side.
Me too.
You know, I was thinking today, there's, you know, that cliche, old Western cliche, shoot first and ask questions later. Everybody in the story seems to do that.
Yeah. They were tough times. They were very, very, you know.
So
there was no justice. There was no law in most of those places. And when there was, they were all on, you know, a lot of them were on the take. And it was, you know, if you're on my side, you get a little justice. If you're not, well, we're going to take you out back, you know. So
he's one character refers to him as Scalper, gives him that sort of that nickname. How does that come about?
Well, Zebediah Creed grew up. He was a slave to the Lakota Indians in the North Plains. And it, from the time he was about 11 years old, that's the backstory. If you'd read, when you read An Eye for an Eye, you'll find out a little more about his backstory. And, he and his brother, Jonathan, were raised as white slaves. And then they were integrated into the tribe and they both became, Sundance warriors. Mm-hmm. So that's why everywhere he goes, people ask him, says, raise your shirt. I want to see your scars. You know, I really want to see who you are. And he had these, you know, he had the scars from the antlers and being hung for, you know, 3 days and nights, through that ceremony. And so he lived the life of, Plains at Lakota. And so he had no qualms in taking your scalp if he thought it, you know, suit some purpose. So, he did it all through the three books. Well, he really called scalper in the first of the third book, but, throughout the first and second, he scalped a few people.
Yeah. You know, you have a character there. There's even one character that's even tougher than the Zeb, and that's this crazy guy we call Willie Dan.
Willie Dan, yeah.
Oh.
He has no morals whatsoever.
He had none. And he misinterpreted Zeb's outcome, I guess. Because he and a couple other people in this conspiracy to assassinate Sam Houston, thought Zeb might go along with it and do the dirty deed. And Zeb had other ideas. But Willie Dan was, he's a cold-blooded killer. If there is anyone to be named that would be him.
You know, one of the big subjects of the story is slavery. Did you want to talk about that a little bit? Because that's, you weave that in very well.
Yeah. Zeb was a slave, so he knows what it's like to be having a leather strap around his neck and tied to a stake out back of a teepee with the dogs. Mm. And then eventually to do the beck and call, you know, if you didn't do whoever told him what to do, he'd end up getting killed. You know, they'd just kill him, or they'd put him out and he'd starve to death or whatever. He had no choice. So he understood that. And when he gets down to New Orleans in particular, and he gets around some of those folks, and in particular, Olgins Pierre was in the first book. Olgins plays a prominent part. He's a free black man, and he has all this money in Haiti. But he has no agency in New Orleans at all. I guess I'm kind of getting in the weeds here, but he understood the horrendous, how horrendous slavery was. And particularly when he goes to Texas and this grand and glorious fight for independence comes down to keeping the cotton plantations open for the millions of dollars being made off the, you know, sending cotton to the British, when the Mexican government wants to shut down slavery and abolish slavery. And he finds out that that's really why they're fighting in the first place. And when I found that out, and I found this group called the Order of the Lone Star, it was quite profound, and I couldn't go back, and Zeb couldn't go back either. Mm-hmm. He had to stand up for it, and yet he's still caught. There's some obligations that he felt he had to fulfill in the second book, and then he had to, because of some blackmail or some really a horrendous act that happens in the third book. Are we giving away spoilers?
No, yeah. We're going to try not to.
Bobby's not. Bobby's shaking her head no.
But he
comes into this conspiracy of of Confederates, already Confederates in the 1830s. Mm-hmm. And they're real people. John Preston, who owned the plantation that I put Zeb in, owned the Hamas plantation in 1836. Everything I do is all the research I do, I try to line everything up where real people are at the place historically. And then I weave my story into their lives.
Mm-hmm.
But Preston went on to South Carolina in 1861. He was the one that gave the great speech to their assembly, state assembly, to convincing them to secede from the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I was able to use him as a character and.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know if that answered your question.
That's fine. Henry, did you have a question? We usually give you an opportunity to ask one.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, I was hearing all of this history. I was wondering how much research you do when you write your stories, or is this knowledge that you already have?
Oh, no. I watched a Neil Gaiman interview. You guys know who he is, right? The big author, English author.
Oh, yes.
Wrote Sandman and
okay.
American Gods and all that. Great author. And I watched part of his master class.
Uh-huh.
And he goes, you know, about research. He says, it's like a smash and grab. You know, you smash and get as much as you can and then use it and, you know, get on down the road. I used to say that I do as much research as I can to get Zeb on down the river. If I need to know, a great example is this character Frenchie. He's in the third book, but he plays prominent in the first book. Who is Frenchie in St. Louis? You know, he runs a bordello called Frenchie's Emporium, you know, so I was doing some research on New Orleans because that's where Zeb ends up. And I ran into some writing about Jean Lafitte, the famous pirate, right? Well, I read this tiny little thing about him that he may not have ended up, you know, in the drowning and off the coast of Veracruz with one of his ships, that he indeed ended up in St. Louis, Missouri, living a life of a gentleman, and went on and wrote a journal, had a journal, and then, you know, he had ancestors that swore that this was Jean Lafitte that lived in St. Louis. So I thought, wow, Frenchie's Jean Lafitte. And so I just, you know, and that really culminated the end of book one because of everything that happens now, because of who we find out Frenchie really is. And this famous pirate privateer. So I was able to craft, and it is at this point, you're crafting the story with a character that you may or may not really know who they are, but you go with it. I mean, if it's a compelling enough story and you can get away with it, and I did, you know, and then he comes back in the third book and plays a pretty profound part of the third book. So John Lofton, you know,
right. Yeah,
and in his journals, he was called John Lofton. I have his journals back here, you know? So, you know, you go with the research, I go just enough to get something to continue the story.
Right.
And, and that in itself oftentimes takes the story in a different place, you know, than where I would have ever thought it would.
Mm-hmm.
So.
What else, Henry? You had another question.
Well, it just sort of led into the idea of, do you outline a great deal? Do you know where you're going in detail before you get there?
Not in detail. Nothing's ever in detail. I took a bunch of notes and, you know, I thought I'd answer. What I do is I take notes, you know. A lot of names of characters come to me. Like Dan Smooth, but everybody calls him Dan Smooth. I think I'll put that in my latest book. You know, that came to me. So I write that down.
Mm-hmm. Where did
What I do is I have an idea of where he ends up. You see.
So how he has to get
where he ends up.
Where's he
and
going?
It's when I go, I'm being very emphatic tonight, but when I go to the keyboard, that's when the story happens. Mm-hmm. That's when the book comes alive. Mm-hmm. I can think about it and I can take notes and I can do outlines until the cows come home. But it's writing the story, writing the book, that it happens. I've had characters, in the first book, Baumgartner, the guy that killed his brother. He's two chapters. He's supposed to show up two chapters later, but he's walking through the door. It's a windy, rainy night. The door blows open and there's Baumgartner. My fingers put Baumgartner there at Sophie's Bordello. And now Zeb has to deal with that because he's there to kill the guy that killed his brother.
So where do the fireflies, where did the fireflies come in?
I just made it up. I thought it was a great visual idea of someone dying. Because I go back to the first book when Jonathan, his brother died. He was killed. I mean, that started the whole trilogy off, really. And it started Zeb making these choices that he then had to, the consequences. It's always a choice, consequence, you know, and that's really all three books is Zeb making choices and then sometimes suffering the consequences or having to, follow up. That's the loyalty. That's his way he does business. But Jonathan, he had these dreams. Zeb had these dreams while he's being brought back to health by Anna and her doctor, father. And I just use that as a kind of a visual of one dream. Jonathan, he speaks to Zeb and then he wanders off through the forest and the fireflies follow him. And they just, and then he disappears and the fireflies just kind of like in a forest, the fireflies kind of go off and suddenly it's dark, you know?
Well, as a reader, I appreciated the times when things got a little quiet. The pace is rip-roaring, and there's lots of action and lots of characters. I would find myself, my heart's pounding, I'm turning pages.
That's good.
So when there are, even though the fireflies come at that type of time that you're talking about, but at the same time, it allows the reader to, we can take a breath.
Take a breath.
I can take a breath. Every time Zeb gets to take a breath, we really appreciate it.
He doesn't get much time.
He doesn't get much to eat either.
No, he doesn't.
But he savors, when he does get a biscuit or he savors the food. And again, as a reader, I think you as a writer, you put us there and we're having that biscuit and we're smelling and so that makes it a pleasurable read as much as it's, this is an action book. It just is. And I'm looking at time. Oh my gosh. So we've already talked about a little bit of process. Let's see. Let's ask one more process. We don't even hardly have time.
We have to ask, my gosh.
What's next? I've talked to Sally.
Oh no, it's wonderful. So what's next, Mark? What are you working on?
What's next? Yeah. Well, back to the book, the short story and the dialogue and the play, the song, Old Lady on the Run. Okay. I was going to write a play about this, and it's about my grandmothers and her two sisters and their in their early days, in order to survive, they started stealing, and then they ended up being robbing banks. And for about six months, they become the most famous outlaws in Oklahoma.
It sounds like
where I grew up. It's all fiction. I have to say, it's all fiction.
Sounds great.
And one thing I will tell you, my mother has been my collaborator for all three of these books. I think she knows Zeb probably better than I do. And I just have to give a shout out to Judy Jackson, Judith Ann Jackson, my mother, who's really been instrumental in saying, well, Zeb wouldn't do that. He'd do this. You know? So,
Mark, where can our listeners follow you, find you, buy your books? Where can they go?
They can buy my books anywhere. You know, Amazon, Barnes and Noble. I think Bookshop may even have them. They might tell you that they're sold out, but
they're on our page. Yes.
There's a couple of bookstores in Oklahoma City, Full Circle Books. If you order my books through them, they're signed. So I left them some signed books. Same with Best of Books in Edmond.
And your website is
www.markcjacksonwriter.com.
All right.
So,
well, thank you, gentlemen. Both, don't go away. We're going to wrap the show, and we're delighted that you're still with us. And Mark, we really thank you for being with us. How fun. We have to have you back because there's just way too much to talk about.
Can I mention one more thing? Just 10 seconds.
Okay.
I'm making a short film with Alfred Williams on the hanging. So I want to ask Henry one question. How do I get Zeb on Netflix? So I'll leave you with that. Leave you with wondering those.
Oh, my goodness. We like to always sort of finish with a quote. And I think that you, I'm reading the quote and you're holding up the books.
That's right.
We're watching our time. Okay. We have been reading Stephen King's book on writing. Yeah. And we like his observation that the editor is always right. But he goes on to say, the corollary is that no writer will take all of his or her editor's advice, for all have sinned and fallen short of editorial perfection. Put another way, to write is human, to edit is divine.
That's great.
Join
That's
us
some
next,
really good editors.
This is we're loving this book. Next week, our special guest will be Carol Van de Henda, and she's written a book called The Goodbye Orchid Series. We'll be talking about both of her books next week. And I guess we have to say thank you for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
It's been great, Jim. We've had a good time.
Till we meet again next week.
All right.
It's always a great day out west.
You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.